So my title is The Dying of the Dark and the Death and Rebirth of the Catholic University. For those of you who may not know, the title is an allusion to a 1998 book by a priest professor at the University of Notre Dame named Father James Burchill, who wrote a book called The Dying of the Light. The Dying of the Light is the story of secularization of higher education, in which he explores about eight different faith traditions. And those of you who know something of the history of modern or American higher education doubtless know that that story has been a pretty consistent one of institutions that almost entirely were founded by various religious denominations or religious orders, and which in a very consistent and sort of single unidirection, a kind of ratchet wrench that only moves in one direction, moved toward a kind of a secular direction. This is not unlike the same story told really almost exclusively about Protestant institutions, and George Marsden, another Notre Dame faculty member for a long time, Marsden's book, The Soul of the American University, which told that story about largely Protestant institutions. Now, this is what Burchill tells in his book, which is well worth reading, is largely a story of what we call secularization, and in particular is about the process of disaffiliation that took place, really kind of began and then snowballed around the turn of from the 19th to the 20th century, and then through about the middle part of the 20th century. So it really was a kind of a movement that you saw fairly consistently in a kind of fairly compact set of decades in the early part of the 20th century to about the middle part. And while his Burchill study is really focused extensively on Protestant institutions, there's a section of the book also about Catholic institutions. In the words of one reviewer, Burchill told the story, and I quote, "the gradual but effective separation of the church and the academy, a church of various denominations." Now, what's striking about his story, though, is that while most Protestant schools completely disaffiliated from their founding orders or founding denominations, most Catholic schools did not completely disaffiliate. In fact, still retain the name of Catholic. It's actually relatively few Catholic institutions that have completely disaffiliated from the church. It's a distinct, somewhat distinct version of the story that he tells. But while it's true that Catholic institutions largely have retained an affiliation, an official affiliation of some form with the Catholic label, nevertheless, what his story does tell is of the kind of effective separation, particularly of governance by authorities within the church. Particularly, we could say, articulated most famously in the Land O'Lakes statement that's 50 years old this year and being celebrated or lamented in various quarters that I've been noticing of late. But in effect, though most Catholic institutions retained this identification with Catholicism. And even in some ways, you could say, particularly, you know, thinking about my time at Georgetown, they were quicker often to articulate an affiliation with the founding order than necessarily with Catholicism. That the effective disaffiliation really in the end ended up emulating key aspects of the disaffiliated and secular, increasingly secular Protestant schools. We could look at a whole range of areas where this is true. The first, I think, most clear, near and dear to the heart of my colleague, Professor Father Bill Miscampbell, is the effective secularization of hiring that took place. Now, you had a move toward, particularly in the Catholic institutions, a move toward lay faculty. And for a long period of time, it was more or less expected that a Catholic institution would hire people who would often have to sign statements of fidelity to the church, would have to declare their fidelity to church teachings. But eventually, most of these institutions moved away from this to the point in which it would be unthinkable to ask faculty to sign some kind of a statement of fidelity to the Catholic faith. In fact, it's actually more likely the case that if you're at a Protestant school that remains affiliated with a Protestant tradition, that you might be asked to sign some kind of a statement of fidelity. I applied for a job and was interviewed for a job once at Pepperdine University, and I had to write a statement, even though I was a Catholic, about why I would support the affiliation of Pepperdine. Father Legge was just mentioning, the disintegration of the curriculum as a key feature in many ways of the broader disaffiliation of institutions from their religious orders, the loss of a sense of what we're about, of something comprehensive, ordering the disciplines and the relationship of the disciplines. So exactly what Father Legge was describing, the experience of so many students today in this kind of disorienting smorgasbord in which you're given no nutritional value or a kind of what course you should take. Literally, you know, you might end up eating dessert first if you study rocks for jocks or something before you study theology. The movement in most of these institutions from what had been various departments of theology or studies of theology, Cardinal Newman discusses as kind of the queen of the sciences and the distinctive mark of a particularly Catholic institution, but all these institutions would have some kind of theological training, and the move from theology to religious studies, to increasingly the kind of either historical study of religion, anthropological, sociological study of religion, religion as a studyable phenomenon that doesn't take as true the theological claims, but rather studies it as some kind of phenomenon that can be dissected according to the normal disciplines of higher education. You also see the effective, what I would call the kind of privatization of religion and religious faith on many of these campuses, certainly in many of the Catholic institutions at Georgetown. Typically when one would want to discuss the Catholic mission of Georgetown, one would be pointed to campus ministry as carrying that particular duty, rather than understanding that Catholicism had to be in some ways penetrating every aspect of the university and informing every aspect of the university. It was increasingly sort of, you could find it down one particular hallway on campus. One saw not only loss of Catholic identity in the faculty, but increasingly also the student body. And this was a kind of issue at Georgetown when I was there. Roughly, it was said that roughly 50% of the student body was Catholic, but that had to be many, many nominal Catholic students, to the point in which one would, as a faculty member, you'd feel uncomfortable talking about Catholic teaching in one's classes because it would be seen as somehow a kind of minority or sectarian view on what was otherwise a Catholic campus. And what would follow this as well would be the liberalization, you could say, of student life and the expectations of student life, to the point in which at Georgetown today you have what I've read recently, the creation of an LGBTQ dormitory on campus, being founded in the name of its Jesuit and Catholic identity. What you also see is, described in this kind of disaffiliation is a kind of, on the one hand, a very intense scrutiny of any authoritative statement or claim by a member of church authority and hierarchy. So that anything that would seem to conform to the demands of the hierarchy is regarded with great suspicion and scrutiny. Whereas demands by the government, for example, or demands by accreditation agencies are regarded as authoritative. So authority doesn't go away. It's just a question of where the authority is. Now this story, and I could go on and on about this general trajectory that tracks the developments at most Protestant institutions, disaffiliated Protestant institutions, has been the story at nearly every Catholic college or university founded roughly before 1950. Now, once this trajectory was discerned and became really evident by the middle part of the 20th century, there were efforts made by many to reverse this course. And if these efforts were successful, they tended to be successful at the non-prestige liberal arts level, not at the research university level. And you can point to at least a few colleges. I was just at Franciscan University. That would be a place that reversed course. They were on the same path They had an enormously, I think, visionary leader, priest, president, who insisted on changing the course of Franciscan and was successful in doing so. Another would be Belmont Abbey, a 19th century Benedictine school that has reversed its course as well. But for the most part, what you see, what one saw, was that orthodoxy in some ways was seen as only feasible in new colleges that could be founded expressly in the effort to maintain fidelity to the deposit of faith. And so you see a number of relatively newer, particularly liberal arts colleges, so not especially research universities with graduate schools, Ave Maria, Benedictine, Christendom College, Thomas More College, and one could go on. But these are, one has to acknowledge, for all of the admirable qualities of these institutions, they're relatively small. They occupy a very niche place in American higher education. They are non-prestige schools, and they have a very small market, I think it's fair to say. They're always looking, and I think a little bit worried about the size of the market that they can appeal to. Just the other day, there was an article on Catholic University that appeared in Chronicle of Higher Education questioning whether their effort, and I think a rather unique effort of a research university to really kind of push back against these trends, whether that effort has in fact resulted in being too churchy, as the author of that article put it, suggesting that they'll be successful if they go the path of every other institution. But nevertheless, that there is a question about how big of a market there is for these kinds of institutions. So what I'm describing then is an effort that's been largely sort of two-pronged, the effort to restore the Catholicity of the legacy schools, the sort of schools of prestige, and to support the creation of new and smaller but distinctive traditional schools. Both of these efforts seem to me to face deep and profound challenges. By and large, the effort to reverse these trends among the legacy schools has been largely unsuccessful, in my view, especially given, when those are research universities, the demands of conformity to the kind of dominant model of what constitutes success at research universities. The associated criteria of rankings and the kinds of publications one has to produce that, frankly, tend exactly the direction that Father Legge was talking about, highly specialized, highly fragmented, not the kind of thing you used to see published, for example, in the Review of Politics, back when they would publish things by Jacques Maritain, that an average layperson, non-academic, could read with great profit. And now, if you read the Review of Politics today, it's very sort of narrow academic studies of political theory. I'm all for that. That's great. But why should the Review of Politics do this when there are so many other academic journals that are doing this? So the challenge of the research universities, let's say the prestige schools, is significant. But the challenge facing non-prestige, more orthodox Catholic schools, it seems to me, is the challenge faced more generally in higher education today, the challenge that we're seeing across the board for non-prestige schools at a time when people are decreasingly willing to pay the freight of a private school tuition at, let's say, less highly ranked institutions, the tendency to move either to community colleges or to state universities. Some of the bright lights, like Benedictine, seem to be doing well, but others, I think, are in sotto voce terms struggling. Now, all these efforts have taken place in the context of, I think, the belief that higher education was a place that could sustain a kind of pluralism, and that there could be the possibility of restoring this kind of different model. This was, of course, during a time, I think, when this was occurring, during a growing self-conscious confidence, particularly among Catholics, that corresponded with the papacy of John Paul II and Benedict XVI, and as well as the kind of social and political influence of evangelicals. But I think at this point, we'd have to say that that confidence is on the wane. These various prospects seem to be deeply challenged. What I want to suggest here tonight, and at least to spend a little time reflecting on, this was all throat clearing, by the way, was the need to reflect on the nature of this process of secularization and what we mean by secularization. In particular, I think that we need to reflect on this process that has shaped higher education as a whole and to which or against which Catholic institutions have shown no particular immunity. What this nature of the nature of secularization in higher education in the American context, what we need to understand is it takes a particular form. And we use this word secularization a bit, sort of in a vague sense. Nietzsche was a secularizer. But when we talk about secularization, we're not talking about, you know, the sort of the withering critique of the slave mentality of Christianity. The kind of secularization we're talking about is very distinct. I think what we have to understand about the nature of secularization within the American context is that it is not simply some uniform process, but that it results from development specifically within American Protestantism, almost always, and I would indeed go so far as to say pretty much almost exclusively, from a perceived threat from Catholicism. If we think about the exact period of time when this secularization is happening in higher education, what's happening in America? Well, first what we see is this corresponds exactly with that period of time that we call progressivism. Progressivism as a political movement, but I think more deeply a kind of theological religious movement. Right? A movement that is in many ways a Protestant reaction, in particular, against the growing presence of Catholics in America. Right? Lots and lots of Catholics entering the United States. The immigration waves that happen leading to the middle part of the 19th into the early part of the 20th century presents a real threat to what had been an order that, while diverse within the Protestant world, nevertheless, in a sense, you could say, was defined or understood itself as defined by its essential Protestantism. This rising wave of immigrants, Catholic immigrants, Irish, Italian, Polish, Eastern Europe, saw then a kind of a reaction from the, let's say, the dominant order, understanding that it had to in some ways change and alter itself in response to this influx. And this wave of inspired was a move within Protestantism to claim to being more universal than any sectarian view, to re-describe itself as non-sectarian, as universal, what we today call secular. This movement was the first backdrop for the disaffiliation of the Protestant schools, the effort to drop the sectarian identification while embracing and identifying a new universal kind of pedagogy and self-understanding. This was not yet secular, because at this point it actually continued to identify itself as Christian in the early waves of progressivism and the progressive transformation of education. So it was not secular in the sense of differentiating itself from atheism. But it was, you could say, sotto voce, a kind of effort to differentiate itself from Catholicism. The second movement that I would describe would be the late 20th century effort now to empty the public square even of the Christian identification. The fear of comprehensive doctrines, the fear of the imposition of views upon society that were often described as comprehensive doctrines understood to be religious. This movement was especially marked by the publication in the late 80s and early 90s of two influential works by two Harvard philosophers, political philosopher and a philosopher. Judith Sklar, a political philosopher, publishes an essay and then a book called The Liberalism of Fear, which describes liberalism as an effort in some ways to defend a kind of or to establish a kind of order of peace that describes liberalism in largely negative terms, the prevention of cruelty, and in particular the cruelty that she sees arising from the wars of religion. And roughly the same time, 4 years later, John Rawls's Political Liberalism, again, a work that in which he describes that liberalism is effectively the effort to avoid comprehensive doctrines defining society. These writings were bolstered as well by non-Harvard thinkers such as Richard Rorty, who describes religion as a conversation stopper in 1994. And again, what's interesting is to notice the kind of compact time frame in which all of these works are published. What's happening at this time? Well, the rise of a kind of newly confident religious belief, particularly manifested in evangelicals, but also a kind of growing sense of Catholicism in the JP2 Benedict XVI era. To take each of these in turn a little bit more specifically, progressivism, we could say in many ways, is defined, one of its key definitions is to emphasize the nation as the carrier of what had been the kind of tradition of America, and indeed that the nation becomes the carrier of progress, the place of progress. In many ways, the transferal of what had been the kind of Protestant location of belief within the church to the political structure, a kind of transference from politics, from the church into politics. Politics becomes invested with a kind of sacral dimension, a kind of salvific project. You see these in various works. John Dewey has an essay called Christianity and Democracy in the late 19th century, in which he talks about the ongoing revelation of God through democracy, democracy as the continuation of Christianity. Walter Rauschenbusch, another major Protestant thinker, 1892, right around the same time, forms a group called the Brotherhood of the Kingdom, and the charter of this group declares that the Spirit of God is moving men in our generation toward a better understanding of the idea of the kingdom of God on earth, so that the kingdom of God is manifest or made manifest through politics. Or Herbert Croly, another great progressive figure, who in his Promise of American Life believed that through a renewed and elevated national project that such an effort might bring about what he called the perfection of human nature. Now this was the backdrop in which transformations of pedagogy were happening, and in particular the creation of what we now today to be the public schools. This is the atmosphere which gives rise to the Common School movement, most famously associated with Horace Mann. The effort to create a schooling that would undergird this effort to invest in the nation, this almost salvific project. Right? This is also the same time when we see the creation, for example, of the Pledge of Allegiance. Written by, anyone know who wrote the Pledge of Allegiance? Francis Bellamy. Edward Bellamy's cousin, who wrote the best-selling book Looking Backwards, a Socialist Utopia. Francis Bellamy was a pastor who was a Christian socialist, self-described Christian socialist. Right? It originally did not appear with the words under God in the pledge. That was the Knights of Columbus later on. Nobody's allowed to take a picture. This was how you would salute the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag. They amended that in 1942. What we see here is an effort through the schools to create a kind of a sense of nation, a membership in the nation. And Horace Mann's efforts is to spearhead a transformation of what had been largely denominational pre-collegiate education in favor of what are called the common schools, right? What is this? It's creation of something common. Which in spite of trying to transcend what had been denominational differences, essentially folds Protestantism into what is now called a secular school. For example, at this time, great debates are had whether or not, not whether the Bible should be read, but whether or not Catholic children should be required to read the required translation, the King James, the Protestant Bible. There are canon battles in Pennsylvania over this question. Imagine Catholics once cared about which Bible they read, that they read the Bible at all. This period was described in a recent amicus brief by the Beckett Fund, I think quite accurately, about this period. I quote, "As the Catholic population in the United States grew, sectarian, this word sectarian, took on an even more precise and more pejorative meaning. In response to the waves of Catholic immigration in the 19th century, nativist groups such as the anti-immigrant Know-Nothing Party grew in size and political power. These groups sought to ensure the ascendancy of their view of the common religion of the United States in the common schools and to keep out sectarian competition, enacting measures such as requiring the reading of the King James Bible in public schools and enacting measures barring any public funds to sectarian schools." So what we call secularism or secularization is actually a particular thing. It's the, let's say, the effort to, in the self-description of now a kind of common, the description of a common school or a common effort to fold Protestantism as the norm, as the undiscerned norm that underlies what is now seen as a non-sectarian form of education. What becomes sectarian are the Catholics, and we're not going to support those schools because those are sectarian, whereas the common schools are informed by a deeply Protestant set of beliefs. Two of the main aspects of this effort, you could say, is animated in particular by Protestant theology and Protestant, political philosophy, particularly as it grows out of the liberal political philosophy. The primacy of the individual and the elimination of mediation. Why is the nation so important? Because you need to create the sense that there is nothing between the individual and the nation. There is no longer any mediation. This is post-Civil War. Right. The Pledge of Allegiance is one of the ways you overcome any sense that there's a mediation. All of the authors I just mentioned, Dewey and Crowley, emphasize that there has to be a direct relationship between the individual and the state, direct identification between the individual and the state. And the state is now the carrier of a vision of the realization of a kind of new apotheosis. Right. The nation becomes the carrier of this. This is still described in Christian terms. Let me just turn quickly to the second development, this more recent development that I described in the late 80s, early 90s. The second development, which under the guise of eliminating comprehensive doctrines and insisting on the fact of pluralism, to use John Rawls's own language, begins by being based on the claims of the fear of a new war of religion breaking out. Belief, the rise of the religious right in particular, animates this fear that unless liberalism reasserts itself by eliminating comprehensive doctrines from the public sphere, Richard John Neuhaus's, right, some of his great work, right, The Naked Public Square, a response to this effort. But the claim here, once again, was the denial that this proposal itself was not a comprehensive doctrine. That this proposal, in fact, didn't already contain a kind of already a deep and sort of subterranean set of commitments. This effort to strip the public square of comprehensive doctrines shrouded what had already been the success of secularized Protestantism to claim the mantle of neutrality. But all along, if again, just reading Rawls, favors the stance of a privatization of religion. Which religion is going to benefit in a naked public square? A religion that's already privatized, that's already understood to be personal and individual. Is based on a view of society essentially, Reinhard Huderbeck there, a Gesellschaft, a society of contract. Everyone in a Rawlsian world is essentially always has the social contract in their head. Right? It sort of places the state of nature right inside your head. And all the time you have to think of yourself essentially as I am one of the sort of cogs, the individual units that create society. There's nothing organic or natural about human society. A universalized social contractarianism then required of every individual. The residual presence of Christian charity, notice secularization isn't neutral, a residual Christian charity now redefined as social welfare directed and distributed through the state. And what's interesting and particularly relevant is in contrast to the older progressives, an increasing suspicion of nationalism as itself an arbitrary limit on the individual. Right? The state now constitutes unnecessary mediation. And what you also see articulated at this period of time is a growing interest and effort to propound cosmopolitanism. Martha Nussbaum's work at this time, Anthony Kwame Appiah, cosmopolitanism, Thomas Pogge, now rather disgraced, but who criticized Rawls for being too wed to the idea of the nation. Now, this was recognized by a number of Rawls's critics at the time, Michael Sandel, Father Newhouse, Robert George. Rawlsian liberalism, like its predecessor, progressive liberalism, hid its commitments behind a shroud of neutrality. And these commitments were actually, in their deepest sense, already deeply sectarian, already deeply religious, but were done so in order to define one particular religion as sectarian, as opposed to the true universality of modern society. What's particularly striking about this second iteration, this more recent iteration, is that this has led to the full flowering of a new established, I would call it a religion, the religion of secularized liberalism, qua Protestantism. Its new temples are our leading universities. It has its orthodoxies. Again, these are seen especially on college campuses today. The orthodoxy of self-creation, of a borderless world constituted by unbounded individuals. And in this context, what do we see? A remarkable new willingness to limit academic freedom where it confronts or contradicts the new orthodoxy. A new priesthood of authorities, particularly in the administrative class. Right? The old priests used to run these institutions. Now we have the new priests who are ready to bring dissenters to heel. Those have been following activities at Marquette University, for example. Professor John McAdams has been fired. Tenure proved to be no protection. Academic freedom proved to be no protection when it turned out he was against the orthodoxy of this new establishment, which happened to be in contradiction to the actual claims of what Catholicism taught at a place like Marquette. We also saw this recently with Paul Griffiths at Duke, right, who ran afoul of his administrators. We even see this new orthodoxy, in a way, reinscribing the old orthodoxy in interesting ways. Harvard University recently rewrote the last line of its alma mater, Fair Harvard, which used to read, may we protect and defend beauty, truth, and goodness till the last of the stock of the Puritans die, was the last line. And this was eliminated as not being inclusive enough, which suggests to me that on the one hand, the last of the Puritans died, but on the other hand, the Puritans are still very much governing, are very much still in control. This is an all too brief sketch of a very complex history. In order to elucidate, I hope, or at least suggest, why Catholic higher education has been so deeply undermined, indeed has undermined itself in America. While supposedly a place that recognizes, to use Rawls's term, the fact of pluralism, the fundamental political and theological architecture of America has been fundamentally structured against Catholicism, against its core commitments, not focusing or giving place of primacy to the individual. Understanding human beings is embedded in relationships. That's part of the Trinity, part of the Holy Family, the self-sacrificial nature, but also drawing on Thomistic and Aristotelian understandings of human beings as naturally political animals, as not constituted by a social contract from a state of nature, and so forth. Now, while this architecture has been in many ways tilted against Catholic views, Catholic belief, and Catholic institutions, this has been deeply compounded, indeed, you could say, capitulated, particularly through the Catholic desire to make it in America, to be on par with or equals. And Catholics were constantly being offered terms that what seemed to be acceptable compromises. Right? You can think of when John F. Kennedy ran for the presidency in 1960, he's called down to Houston to speak before the Protestant ministers, the Baptist ministers, and they rake him over the coals on whether or not he will follow the Constitution or will he obey the Pope if for example, he decides to follow Catholic teaching on contraception. The fear was that JFK would ban contraception. JFK said that he would sooner resign his position than advance anything that contradicted the Constitution. Now, this is an interesting kind of question. Why would this be off the table if this is a sort of a liberal democracy? But it was already understood, and JFK understood, there's a tilt. Right? Protestant presidents weren't brought before Catholic ministers or priests to explain how they could possibly justify advancing things like contraception and abortion. That was never a question. It was always, right? Why does Mario Cuomo have to go to Notre Dame and give a speech in which he explains his view as a pro-life politician, as a pro-life Democrat, will be that he personally disagrees with it, but as a political matter has to conform to the justly decided Roe versus Wade? Why can't he simply get up and say, I think this was wrong, and I'm going to work like hell to reverse this? Because he understands the trajectory goes in one direction. So given all this deep challenge, why do I call this talk The Dying of the Dark and not Dying of the Light Part 2? Just a couple reasons. First, it seems to me that now in revealing itself as a new establishment, something new and visible is available to us in ways that I think hasn't been for quite a while. This form of secularism is revealing its deepest commitments, and it now feels sufficiently empowered and dominant to remove the shroud of neutrality that it had long claimed. And of course, right now, following the election of Donald Trump, we see the panic that has ensued given the perceived threat to this, what was regarded as the course and arc of history and a kind of hegemonic stance. This position, I think, is increasingly understood to be very brittle, in many ways unsustainable, certainly intolerant. In striking ways, particularly when we speak of the university, it's increasingly, again, an echo, Father Legge, increasingly unable to offer meaning to the young people. There's been a series of postings recently on the Atlantic website by James Fallows. If you haven't seen these, I recommend them. The title of them, I think, is The Future of Elite Schools. And what's striking about this is a kind of self-awareness, even among an elite liberal part of the establishment, of how poorly elite institutions are serving their students. In the one he posted yesterday, he quoted from a Harvard student, and I quote from his posting, from this letter from the Harvard student, quote, I could fill a book with the conversations I've had with my mental health care providers, a chapter on the social isolation I felt here at Harvard, on what I should do with my life, on the merits and drawbacks of exclusive affinity groups already in a departmentalized school, on the unhealthy stress of crippling student loans and the brewing envy and resentment of those without such loans. That's just the first part of this letter. It's extraordinary. It's a heartbreaking letter. I gave a talk recently at University of Pennsylvania. I learned there that 14 suicides among students occurred since 2013, roughly the last 5 years. This suggests to me that the dying of the dark, to put it, is a kind of foreseeable, perhaps in our lifetime. This might be very bad in the sense that I think we may see largely the loss of the liberal arts tradition in our colleges and universities, maybe just outside of the most selective schools. But I think we also have to, and I think the anxiety felt at these institutions is very real, that this could all just blow up, Once everyone decides, like in 2008, these things aren't worth anything anymore, guess what? They won't be worth anything anymore. And it seems to be just as possible to happen. Yet all of this does not suggest or affirm the second part of my talk, the rebirth of the Catholic University. And in this sense, I thought I should offer a little bit of hope, even though I don't have a lot about Catholic universities today. I think these trends toward this form of secularization of Catholic universities is likely to continue long before it's possible to reverse them, at least on the basis of how these institutions are currently run. What's striking to me is that given every evidence that secular institutions, what we call secular institutions, have become morally untethered, intellectually stifling, financially unsustainable, and are evidently willing to bankrupt the next generation, that the Catholic institutions still want to ape them. It's stunning to me. So while we can't discount the possibility of what Taleb calls a black swan event, and it seems to me this is pretty ripe for a black swan event, given the brittleness of this current system, and what he describes in particular as the likelihood of systemic failure when one creates a monoculture in which one bad event will then spiral out of control. I think, in some ways, I think the greatest hope and promise right now is building resiliency within institutions that probably are not going to be easily turned. And here I'll end by giving props to things like the Thomistic Institute, to programs within current prestige Catholic institutions, my own university, the Tocqueville Program, Center for Ethics and Culture, Institute for Church Life. These are places of extraordinary dynamism and promise, and I think our students are flocking to these programs because it's, even in Catholic institutions, it's giving them a sense of order and a sense of what a Catholic education is like. There are also lots of programs in or near non-Catholic schools, like this Catholic Center here at NYU, the Newman Centers and the Catholic Centers, and again, slightly off-campus institutions like the Thomistic Institute that I think it's an extremely good model. And then there are Catholic-friendly programs within schools, elite and non-elite, the Madison Program, Morningside Institute here in New York, and so forth. One thing that I think we haven't thought enough about in thinking about how to restore or revive Catholic institutions is to think about where the customers are now going. Where are the vast majority of Catholics going to school? It's not Catholic universities, it's public universities. And to think increasingly about how we serve those students. And I think we are seeing efforts to build, again, on-campus or near-campus institutions that can give those students a sense of what a Catholic education would be like at the institutions that the market now is sort of forcing them to attend. We might call this the Thomistic option or the Newman option. We have to recognize and acknowledge that these will appeal to students who already have a good Catholic formation for the most part. The students who will know, I got to make some time of the day to go to Mass down at the Thomistic or down at the Newman Center and go to this Bible study group. But we need to serve those students and also be there for the seekers, for the kids now who are being served only by their mental health workers and who might be passing by. And if there's a door open, would go in and find something there. So I think, unfortunately, in spite of my title, that we're unlikely to see the renaissance of full-blown Catholicity at our legacy schools. We're likely to see the continuing struggles of the smaller, more orthodox schools. But we should seek to expand those pockets and those places of fidelity where they exist, both at Catholic institutions and at non-Catholic institutions. And as our current course seems to lead us to exhaustion, to be ready for the dying of the dark, which might just be an opportunity for kindling a new light. So, thank you.
We have a few minutes, and Dr. Dineen has generously agreed to take some questions. So if anyone has questions, he'll field them himself.
Yes, sir.
Your talk actually seems far more optimistic than I expected.
Call me bushy-tailed and bright-eyed.
No. I mean, would you cast your remarks in terms of like Weber's ethics of responsibility? I mean, it seems to me what that means at the bottom is all about pluralism. Incremental reason is one, and there's scarcely any room left for grades.
Yep.
And I don't hear anybody talking about that. I'm 60-something years old, I'm a lawyer. I recently stumbled across Augustine's Confessions. It brought me back to the church after 50 mm-hmm. years of really pointless wandering. And so that's why I've come to this talk and why I learned about the Commission Institute. But for me, it was Weber's struggle with what is a very young man that just drove me to despair.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you haven't made the full journey to Christianity yet, because you shouldn't be despairing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I'm not
right.
that bad.
Yeah.
That
oh, no. No.
Now, I would like to hear your thoughts on Weber's ethics of responsibility. And I think it was the kind of quintessential Protestant project,
yeah.
and to suggest that somehow that regime has anything left to react against, it seems to have fallen and collapsed.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we see around.
That's right. Well, I mean, you know, your story is not unlike a lot of stories that I hear among students and among adults, which is stumbling on something like Augustine, right? And let's remember, Augustine stumbles onto the Bible, right? Take and read, and picks up and reads a passage. This is of course always a reason for hope that even in the bleakest times, and we've seen bleak times that are arguably bleaker than this. It does seem like we're caught in a pretty tight web right now. That web of instrumental rationality, the iron cage of Weber's understanding, that it's awfully hard to see our way out of this. And actually, this is why I went back recently and reread The Black Swan, which I read when it came out, and because it struck me that, you know, what Taleb describes in that book, if you haven't read the book, it's not just that things can just suddenly happen. It's just that we tend to we have all these biases that make us think that whatever we see in the world seems so firm and solid. Right? In 2008, the financial sector looked just solid, right? Everyone was, you know, everyone wanted to be on Wall Street, work on Wall Street, take extra loans on their houses. Everything looked so solid. Everyone was long on the market. Everyone was borrowing money. And it turned out it was built on quicksand. But what he describes in particular is that there are circumstances that are more likely to generate a black swan event, a sudden fundamental change in paradigm, how we see things. And those conditions he describes is this kind of brittleness, right? Which when I look at what's going on in places like Harvard, Yale, you know, the effort to shout down anyone who disagrees with you, that's not a sign of confidence. That's a sign of panic, to my mind. Right? The effort to... It's like old communism, right? There was a black swan for you, right? Everyone thought, you know, every political scientist in the world said, we're going to have to deal with the Soviet Union forever, right? There wasn't one who called for the, you know, predicted the fall of the Soviet Union. In retrospect, it looks obvious. It looked like it was riddled with holes like Swiss cheese. But at the time, people thought it was solid. And I suspect that we're not in a situation unlike this, the kind of brittleness of the system reflected by aspects like the kind of campus intolerance that we see today and the insecurity that we see today, but also these growing set of anecdotes from so many young people about how ill-served they are by the system. It's oddly enough, as bad as it is, it's for me a kind of sign of hope. Not that it's going to be pretty as it goes down, but it's going to present certain kinds of opportunities. So I guess I would just say it may not be as solid and as sort of, you know, I just assigned my freshman class 1984. And if you remember at the end of that book, which is sort of in many ways about what was thought to be the permanence of totalitarianism, right? That book ends with the line, right? And it ends with the line that he loves Big Brother, but it comes close to ending with a line that what this regime represents is the boot on the face of humanity forever. And it turns out that it was not sustainable because it didn't conform to human nature. And that's my hope. It doesn't conform to human nature. Yes, ma'am.
One of the places where I see great promise, especially since there's so many young people in the room, is Catholic homeschooling. In our community, there's a large Catholic homeschooling group, and those kids are really solid in their faith. They love their faith, they participate in church activities, and they're just leaders, and they do understand understand the unity of the liberal arts, because their history doesn't start with American government. Their study of history starts with Greek and Roman cultures. And so it takes sacrifice, but what I would recommend to the young people in this room is to embrace Catholic homeschooling, enjoy your children, and grow them into the next leaders.
Yeah, over the years, I've certainly seen some of the most extraordinary students I've had have been the students who come out of homeschooling environments. Either that, or I would also suggest, if you're in a position to do so, the kind of the amazing rise of sort of classical Christian schools, which is, again, something that when I talk to people who advise philanthropists or philanthropists, I say, you know, stop sending so much money to Washington, D.C. and help fund these schools, which could desperately use this assistance. I once heard Bill Kristol give a story when he was working for the Reagan administration. He initially was working for the Department of Education. He told a story that they went in and they had several hundred people who went to the unit on school choice. That was the Reagan commitment, that school choice was going to be the thing they were going to do. And when they got there, what they discovered, they had one person working in the basement on homeschooling. And when they got there, what they discovered was that the real action was homeschooling. I was kind of below the radar at the time, right? So that's why I just ended my talk by suggesting, you know, there's ways that, you know, for those of us in particular get really agonized over what's going on in the Catholic schools, and I'd be the first in line. I teach at one, and I'm agonized about a number of things that go on there. That there's probably a lot of resiliency in places we're not necessarily looking right now. And that might be, you know, the kind of Catholic study places. For example, Purdue University has a very vibrant sort of Newman Center. Like, who would have thought? Purdue, right? The old ag school in Indiana. But a lot of Catholic families are deciding, I'd rather send my child to a place like Purdue to get involved with the Newman Center than I would to Loyola in Chicago. Right? And I can't blame them. So I think we do need to be willing to look at sort of where there's possibilities, and homeschooling has certainly been a very exciting one. Yes, ma'am.
When you were kind of posing your solution in the composite book, The Good Life, you mentioned things like Comiskey Institute or Ethics and Culture at Notre Dame. And I wonder if you could address the criticism of Professor Adrian Vermeule in his review in American Affairs with regard to that. So to recap that, he says that those sort of institutions, those kind of local smaller groups, rely on the goodwill of this religion of secular liberalism. And if they get too successful, they can very easily be crushed. And just as an example, I think it was last week that Harvard suspended for a year its largest Christian fellowship organization because they didn't want to have attracting homosexual men in their leadership. So this was a burgeoning Christian group that now is on probation because they crossed the tenets of secular liberal religion in Harvard. These like small local organizations are good, but they also rely on the goodwill of a host, if you will. Yeah. How do you...
I very much appreciate Adrian's review. Those of you may not have read it, review of my book, Why Liberalism Failed. And he suggested that... I conclude the book by suggesting kind of a what we can do now strategy, which I suggest Rod Dreher and the Benedict option, and we can call it the Thomistic option or the Newman option. There are lots of options. There are lots of orders in the Catholic Church. We don't have to pick just one. Lots of charisms. But that, in other words, that we should think about building, like homeschooling is one way you can begin to build a kind of counter-anti-culture. It's not a counterculture because we don't have a culture. So what is it? It's a counter-anti-culture. So how do you build a culture? Well, it's difficult to do it once it's ceased, once it hasn't been transmitted. But I do think there's a lot of creativity going on. And I just wanted to say, I think that's, if you're looking for, like, what do you do right now, that's something you can do right now. You don't need permission by anybody to start building. And this can be something like the neighborhood I live in South Bend. Over Lent, we had gatherings every Friday night of families eating Meatless Fridays, which turned out to be great celebratory experiences for people to get together and eat grilled cheese together. Right? There are lots of things you can do to build a sense that we're, you know, we're part of something. We're connected, and we have this kind of relationality. But Adrian Vermeule is right that were this liberal hegemonic state to feel the threat, it would come down on you. I give the example. This is just a it's more of a perspective example, but there was a book written by Damon Linker, who's been writing really good stuff for the week. But Damon Linker wrote a book called The Religious Test, in which he talked about homeschooling. And he actually said, as long as homeschooling is a sort of minority activity affecting a very small number of people, the state can tolerate it. But were it to become large, having numerous people, that could potentially change the nature of the liberal state itself, the state would have to come in and suppress it. Right. So this liberal order will defend itself from threats. So this would be my response to Adrian. So Adrian's right about this. The problem with Adrian's suggestion is that I don't think, at least right now, I suspect, this is not the what we call secularization, or this Protestantized secularism. It is the DNA of this nation. And the idea that we're going to sort of, Catholics will take it over, that will be stopped. That will be prevented. Now, who knows? Again, black swans can happen. Things can change. And I do think the other thing that I conclude my book with, which Adrian didn't mention, is that this is a time, this is for you young people out there with the ambitions to abject failure as academics or non-academics, I said, this is actually a unique moment in which political theorizing is necessary. Right? It almost never happens, right? Most political theorists just study what other political theorists said, and they publish irrelevant studies of this, that, or the other person. This is actually a moment when you need the next Hobbes, Locke, Augustine, et cetera. Right? This is a moment. I think it's going to be a kind of linchpin of history where we do need new thinking. And in this sense, I think history has not ended. Fukuyama was wrong. And there's the possibility now, it seems to me, of thinking our way, in addition to acting, but also thinking our way to the kind of post-liberal order.
A fan of mine and
yes.
A fan of his. I think that's very compelling as far as you go. But the criticism is mostly psychological. You're saying people like meaning, students like meaning. What you ultimately need is a philosophic defense of something less than total skepticism. You have to argue for some world in which some things are not questioned, in order other things can be questioned. Mm-hmm. And the feature of her university is that we're saying because everything is questioned, or if it isn't, it's because of the arbitrary assumption of a certain academic study. But we don't really have a philosophic defense of an intellectual mill, which I think you're arguing. Now, maybe the Catholics said...
An intellectual mill?
Yes.
And I didn't hear that.
Intellectual mill.
Intellectual, I just knew.
Middle,
okay. Thank you.
Of some middle between total skepticism and total orthodox.
Yeah.
You're arguing for somewhere in that middle.
Yeah.
And maybe it's been provided in the past by other things. But we need to provide that. That case needs to be made.
Yeah.
Speaking as a Protestant, I'm a little weary of a return to Catholic orthodox.
Yeah. I can imagine you would be, but you've had your turn.
And I also think some of them have to be saved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think that the Catholic tradition can withstand questions.
Yeah.
But anyway, that job still needs to be done.
Yeah, thanks. I'm actually quite skeptical of a sustainable middle. I think human organizations and institutions, societies, need something other than a middle. They're organized around a kind of a set of beliefs. Let me give you the example of academic freedom. What I find interesting about academic freedom. Academic freedom is, of course, it's part of this process. It's part of the secularization process. And it's used in particular as part of the effort to disaffiliate and to, in particular, to allow for this kind of middle position of sort of skeptical questioning of any orthodoxy, right? It's used to protect any questioning of what had been an orthodoxy. And it's justified largely by people who are going to be challenging what had been the existing orthodoxy. So this is the kind of middle position, right? Now, when Mill argues for basically a version of this in On Liberty, what he says is that you need to have the freedom to speak and dispute and question in order that you move from one certainty to another certainty, that you find out what the truth is, it's not a sustainable position to always be just, we're just going to question. You actually move from what had been an unquestioned settlement now to a new settlement. And he says, you're going to settle on what the truth is, and then you might want somebody around occasionally who will challenge that, you know, kind of a devil's advocate. But you already know it's kind of settled. What we have today, it's interesting, is that the people who have the new orthodoxy, our campus secularized liberals, want to restrict academic freedom. Now, who's invoking John Stuart Mill? Robbie George. It's the Catholic conservatives now who find Mill to be their friend. Right? That now the orthodoxy is sort of oppressing them. So it strikes me as a one way of thinking that it's even an institution like a university, which its lifeblood is questioning and challenging, in some ways always has a kind of frame. It always has to define what are questions that are permissible and what are impermissible. And we're having a tough time with that right now, but we're understanding there are certain ones. Professor McAdams at Marquette, I think, discovered what might be one. Wasn't exactly what it was doing. We'll see an interesting case out of Fresno State. Those who are following the Twitter statements by one professor there following Barbara Bush's death. All this is to say, it seems to me that human organizations and societies operate at some level on a kind of deep level, a very deep level, foundational level of agreement in which you can have disputes and controversies. And right now, we're in a period of questioning, is that settlement that we have right now one that's sustainable and desirable? Anyway.
Just a question off the heels of your previous answer. Do you have any advice to any aspiring failures to study political theory? Might get laughed out of both the political science and philosophy departments.
Yeah. Seems like a very personal question, whether I have any advice. Ask for a friend. Well, you want recommendations from the following people. I'll put it this way. It seems to me that if you look at the great philosophers and the great political philosophers, and they're not always the same thing, almost none of them were academics. Right? That the normalization and academization of philosophy and political philosophy, probably theology for that matter, maybe less so because it's within an institution and an organization, has been very bad for the actual practice of political philosophy. For someone who wants to go deep into a questioning of the order of things, one of the worst places to do that is in a university, right? Which, while they purportedly run on deep questioning, are all about sort of aping whatever the sort of norms and standards are at the time, right? We want to publish original work, deeply original work, and we're going to send this out to a referee of three people who are all going to basically say, this conforms to my view of what I already decided is true. You know, it's sort of like Plato would have never gotten through peer review. Right? I'm sorry, but the Republic is not really good research. So the first thing would be, I don't know whether, if you're really interested in doing political philosophy, maybe you want to do some academic study, but I don't know if it has to be done. It probably can't really be done from the academy, at least not in a kind of deeply questioning way. Or maybe if one were to do it, one might want to study for a PhD with some thought of becoming independently wealthy and writing books then. And if you find out how to do that, let me know.
We're past time, but I know there's a lot of hands up. So what I thought we'd do, if this is okay with you, Professor Dineen, I know there's a lot of hands in the back. We'll take three questions, but we're going to do them all together, okay. And then we'll let you pick and choose. And before we have a reception with that Father Legge will tell us about. So I know there's some hands in the back, yeah.
Okay.
Some with the vest, maybe.
Yeah, the vest.
Thank you. Thank you for
inviting me. Stand up so we can hear you.
I did philosophy and education really at Columbia. And I'm taken by, I resonate with the idea that behind every education there is an orthodoxy.
Yeah.
It seems like that's kind of written in education, as you're teaching a group, you're teaching something to someone else,
yeah.
Behind that there's always a doctrine. And I'm wondering if you're thinking about the future of education, the options that we have, if there could be an option that could preserved dialogue, like truly enriching dialogue, maybe through some of these dimensions, like the institute here, but things that are a little bit, that yes, offer a doctrine to the people who want that doctrine already, but also see the value of conversation and kind of make a place for that conversation and you envision that as something possible.
Great.
And then, Bill?
So I wanted to know how you would help assuage the quasi-Marxist fear that this is all, in the end, just a market determinism, that the reason the Protestants got pushed out of Catholic universities is because they were quicker to cast off any qualms they had about making a buck, and that the Catholics don't have anything to sell, and that in the end, we don't have any way to turn a profit on this, and so we're doing it.
And then, please, Matt.
I'm curious what you make of the Lincolnian project to create.
So which?
I'm curious what you think of Abraham Lincoln's project to create a civil religion.
Okay.
And a political religion, and if you would characterize this new political mediation between nation and man between man and man as a continuation of the Lincolnian enterprise, or if it's from another source.
Yeah. These are great questions. Okay, we have an hour.
Plato, Marx, and Lincoln.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, you know. So the first question, I think to have a dialogue, a true dialogue, you have to in some ways share some premises. I mean, at the very base, you have to speak a language, the same language, to truly have a dialogue. But the most interesting dialogues, it seems to me, are usually when you have dialogues with people who share certain premises. I mean, Santa Sanctus can probably testify to this. Munoz and I are constantly at it. We have proxy battles through our students, right? Yeah, I'll lecture and tell my class why Munoz is entirely wrong about the American founding and Abraham Lincoln. And then I found in the next class he's undermined everything I've taught them. And it throws our students, who I think like us both, into a state of profound kind of questioning and trying to figure it out and trying to determine sort of where does the truth lie. But that's because we share a lot of deep premises and we agree on a lot of really fundamental things. I think the most important things we agree on. So I would say that the true dialogue has to share certain premises to start with. But because so many of my colleagues, we share certain premises which end up being in very different places, politically, theologically, and otherwise, I mean, there are lots of implications to the things we debate about. But you can have a conversation with somebody that you share certain premises with in ways you can't with somebody who do. Right. This is McIntyre's contesting, the philosophical traditions, right, that really have no ability to speak to each other. I'm hard pressed to answer the question about the quasi Marxist question about markets. I guess I would just say, just to repeat something I said before. We're very good at addition. So I've been talking a lot of discussion comparing my book to Steven Pinker's book and sort of people saying, well, what about all the statistics of how great things are? And if that's how you measure how great things are, look at rising GDP, et cetera, all the material basis, everything looks great. When you look at a whole different set of measures, here's one measure. How many really close friends do you have in your life? Right, which they've measured this now. And it turns out, not that long ago, in 1980, people had 3 really good confidants, on average. Today, it's 0.8. So you have an eighth of a person that is your really good friend. What constitutes happiness? Is it, I can buy lots of moleskin notebooks? I just walked by the shop and I saw they're $25 each. I couldn't believe it. Or I can hang out with my friend at a cafe and, you know, drink, hopefully not New York price coffee, and sit there for a long time hashing things out. It seems to me by lots of measures that we would say constitute happiness, we're doing miserably. Friendship, marriage, children, community, and so forth. So I'm not so sure the market has been cornered at this point. It seems to me that there's a lot of efforts to say it's been cornered without necessarily guaranteeing that. And lastly, the question about, I don't want to get into Lincoln because I don't want to get Professor Munoz mad at me, but what is striking about just that period I was talking about the Progressive Era, is that it was very much an era of the building of a civil religion following the Civil War. The American Project of Manifest Destiny, the effort to create a kind of Americanization consistent with the idea of a Christianization, what Eric Vogelin called the imminentization of the eschaton. Should be a bumper sticker: don't imminentize the eschaton. Right. What I think we should notice is that this form of secularization all along has been a kind of civil religion. And we call it secularization. That's really the point of my talk tonight. What we call secularization is a kind of civil religion, and it's been submerged as a religion. I do think it's manifesting itself now in this establishment we're especially seeing in the high temples of this religion. And I do think that we have no better example than Augustine about what's wrong with civil religion, what's wrong with making any human institution into a deity. And what's ultimately sort of seems to be contrary to what we know to be true about our humanness, which is that we can't create ourselves into gods, make ourselves into gods, or make this world into the heaven, kingdom of heaven on earth. John Dewey ends his short essay called My Pedagogic Creed with the following statement: I believe the teacher is the true usherer in of the kingdom of God. That's certainly not my job description, at least not in this world. My job is, I hope, to give my students a decent education, and I hope to help them get to heaven. But that's not here, and that's not now. So, thank you very much. Yeah.